Check out my new book, Reach All Readers, at reachallreaders.com. When you pre-order, you'll get special access to my Science of Reading mini course. Learn more at reachallreaders.com. Hello, this is Anna Geiger from The Measured Mom, and in today's episode, I interview Nate Hansford, a teacher and author. His most recent book is called The Scientific Principles of Teaching, and in today's episode, we talk about how teachers can evaluate education research, and then we go more specifically into things like balanced literacy and constructivism, things that we may have thought were supported by research but may not be. So I hope you enjoy our conversation, and be sure to head to Amazon and check out his book. Here we go. Welcome back, Nate.
Hi. You know, it's really cool to be back on your podcast. I actually love being like a returning guest on a podcast. I think it's kind of special. You get to know the host a little bit better.
Yeah. So when I talked to you a long time ago, boy, I'm sure over a year ago, I just wanted to talk to you about research and how that works and how teachers can understand it, because that's something you've spent a lot of time on. And now we get to talk about your book, in which you really break that down for teachers, called The Scientific Principles of Teaching, Bridging the Divide Between Educational Practice and Research. And I was able to get an advanced copy and read through it. My notes are all over it. And I would love to talk about why you wrote it and what it's going to do for teachers. So what was your goal in writing it?
I think my main goal was to promote teacher self-efficacy. I think we've been sort of inundated by this celebrity model in education of, I'm the expert, therefore you should trust my opinion, and everything I say is science and fact. And, you know, we're in the science of reading movement now, and I think that's largely been a good thing. But at the same time, I think we're still kind of trapped a little bit in that celebrity model. There's a lot of celebrities in that space, and sometimes they do sort of say it's science because I said so. Not to like sort of pick on any one individual person, but I think that's a dangerous idea. And I've heard some people defend it and say, well, science is too complex for teachers to understand. They're not scientists. They just have to listen to trusted experts. Mm-hmm. But I think that's really problematic, because how are they determining who's the expert if they don't have any base level understanding of science themselves? So mm-hmm. part of the goal of writing the book was to give teachers a very basic understanding of science, in when it comes to social sciences at least, so that they can understand if the arguments they're hearing make sense from a scientific perspective. But it was also to give them a broad overview and summary of education research, so that they would have an informed position or understanding when they heard new information. So the real goal was so that teachers could evaluate scientific claims themselves with some level of efficacy. Because I really think if we want to have an evidence-based teaching movement, we need to have teachers who understand evidence. Mm-hmm.
So you've talked about in the book, there's this divide between educational practice and research. So in other words, what teachers are doing may not be informed by research, or we think something is, but it's not. Why do you think there is that divide?
I think it's because I think it comes right back to the same thing about celebrity culture. And even in universities, I think that exists. You know, like how many professors absorbed that sort of Fontespanel, Lucy Calkins, Mary Clay model of reading instruction, not necessarily because their research arguments were compelling, because they didn't really present a lot of research, but because what the story they were selling sounded compelling. Mm-hmm. I feel like we've just been inundated for that for so long. You know, look at learning styles. I think a lot of people in that evidence-based teaching perspective know that teaching to learning styles isn't really an evidence-based pedagogy or teaching method. And yet it was so popular. Like, I live in Canada. We actually put into law. We put policies by the Ontario government saying you will teach to learning styles. Oh, and it was like every single program class or course I ever took in education said, you have to teach to learning styles. In fact, I remember thinking, even before I'd learned anything about research, there was just something about it that just didn't sit right with me. It didn't make sense, in the sense that I get this box quiz personality test and I find out my personality, and then suddenly the teacher's going to know better how to teach me. It just doesn't seem to make a ton of sense. Like, if you're a musical learner and your teacher is teaching you via musical style, is that really going to be effective? Like, am I going to learn math via music? Does my music or math teacher need to make a rap about every single formula? Like, it just seems so impractical and illogical. But yet it was a very attractive idea to a lot of people. I think because it like a lot of pseudoscience, it hinges on a little bit of truth. And I think that's what pseudoscience in general does. It takes a kernel of truth and tries to make it universal. And I think we all do learn a little differently. I'm sure somebody would debate me on that, but I think most people would accept that. And we all have different strengths and weaknesses. There are definitely people out there who seem to be better at math than language. Although I would even argue a lot of that might be coming down more to personal preference, because they're actually similar parts of the brain, but that we learn that skill. But I think that little kernel of truth made people really willing to accept that idea of learning styles. And I think it's led to a big divide between what is popular in education versus what is evidence-based. And I've seen a tremendous amount of progress in that regard over the last 4 years. Like, when I first started talking about this and writing about this and blogging about this, I just felt like I was this one weirdo in the dark screaming out on the internet, like, hey, but like everything that's popular is not backed by research, and everything that's backed by research is not popular. And it really feels like, probably nothing to do with me, by the way, but it does really feel like a lot more people have come into the space and are having a lot of success. Like, shout out to Emily Hanford, mm-hmm. who did her podcast, Sold the Story, on this very topic. And a little microcosm of it, at least. And millions of people listen to that podcast. So I think we've made progress, but I think we got to be careful that we don't fall down the same rabbit hole. And I do see, like, people who are selling programs, for lack of a better word, and I'm not going to throw any individual under a bus, trying to claim the science of reading is very specific to their topic or their program. Like, my program is, you know, I've heard people say this exactly. My program is the real science of reading program. Whereas I don't know you would find too many real experts who would agree with that statement. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think, first of all, it's this whole idea of understanding what exactly scientifically based research is and what that even means for something to be research based. I know when I had my first balanced literacy course that I sold a number of years ago, and I had somebody ask me, "Is my principal wants to know if it's research based?" I'm like, and at the time I was like, "Well, I mean, I think so. I mean, I'm doing it." It was a balanced literacy course, so I was like, "Well, it's based on the work of Fanon, Spinal, Lucy Caucus." Like, that's what I told them. That's literally what I told them. My assumption was, well, they'd done the research, and I was following in their footsteps. So yeah, but I didn't even know where to go from that, you know. So that's a really nice thing about the beginning of your book, is it really lays out what exactly is scientifically based research. And you talk about all the little picky things that we need to know without getting too deep. You know, you talk about effect size and things like that. And in a way that's very readable. Like, I think teachers might want to read it a couple of times, but it's definitely very readable, which is great, because when you first get your hands on a scientific study, it's very overwhelming. There was a quote in a book I read, The Reading Glitch, and they said, for most teachers, the idea of sitting with a research article is about as appealing as eating a bowl of cold sauerkraut. Which I agree with, and at least at first. But you show us things to point out. You show us things to take a look at, and you're also good at helping teachers see the gaps in the study, or what makes the study not reliable or maybe as trustworthy as we might like. So maybe we can talk about that, some factors that affect the quality of a study. Because, like people say, you can find a study to support anything, but that doesn't mean you're going to find a quality study to support anything. So what are some things that regular teachers can keep their eyes out for?
Yeah, I mean, the first thing I would point out is identifying what kind of research it is. Because, like, I would say 90% of research, and this is a rough estimate, I'm not citing an exact figure here, but I would say 90% of education research is either qualitative, mm-hmm. theoretical, or a case study. And that's problematic, because those aren't really studies. And I think when people hear the word peer-reviewed, or in a research journal, or this is written by a researcher, they assume it's science. And that's not really mm-hmm. accurate. Mm-hmm. There's so many papers that aren't really science. Like, even the reading rope, and not to throw the reading rope under the bus, it's a great graphic. I often see people cite that as science. In fact, I've even seen reading companies cite, my program is efficacious because of the reading rope. And I'm like, what are you talking about when I see that? Because that's not a study on their program. That's a visual representation of a theory of reading mm-hmm. instruction. So mm-hmm. you can't cite the reading rope as scientific evidence, because it's not science. It's a visual representation of a theory. So one thing we can think about is the basic scientific model for all science is that we have to test ideas. We have to have experiments. So in education, it's generally seen as the basic model of an experiment is we test one group gets the treatment or the teaching method that we want to test. One group does not. So if you have a study that has a control group and a treatment group, you automatically know this is a real scientific study on teaching. Mm-hmm. If you have a paper that's like, we have one group of students, that's a case study. It can be interesting and it can give us interesting data, But it's not, it's not like really hard science version of education research. Similarly, if you have no case study, you just see a summary of their opinion, then you know that's, again, that's more of a theoretical paper. And a lot of things that get published in education journals are just that, either a case study or a scientific theoretical paper. So the basic study format is treatment group versus control group. The second you see that, that's the first thing to look for. The next thing I would look for is, generally speaking, though, I don't think teachers should read individual studies unless there's only like one study on the topic. Like, let's say you're thinking about adopting a program and you find out the company has a study on their website. Well, then it might make sense to read that study and get a little bit of understanding of it. But for the most part, it's something to avoid because education studies can show a really wide range of results. And I've talked about this before. I think this kind of leads to the myth of, well, science can't make up its mind. I mean, I've talked about this before, the analogy of the egg. Everybody's heard on the radio or the news, a new study shows eggs are good for you, or a new study shows eggs are bad for you. And they're like, oh, the scientists can't make up their mind. It's not that the scientists can't make up their mind. It's just that we see variability in science. So you have to look at what does the average result show? And that's why looking at one study, especially like, oh, the one new study is really kind of useless for the most part. Because unless you read every study on a topic, you actually don't really understand what the science shows on the topic. Luckily, we have papers that summarize all of the research on a topic. And the best form of this, in my opinion, is meta-analysis, because it'll tell you what was the average result. And just as an example, I am submitting a meta-analysis for peer review on reading recovery. It's not published yet. I did publish a summary to my blog, but in that study, we found some reading recovery showed really, really positive large effect sizes. In fact, we found one study with an effect size over 3, which is enormous for reading
right,
recovery.
That's crazy. Crazy.
And we found studies with negative effect sizes, where the students who got the reading recovery treatment did worse than the students who did not receive the treatment. So if I want to prove reading recovery works, I would just cite the study that shows the effect size of 3. If I want to prove it doesn't work, I could just cite the study that has a negative effect size. That's why it really doesn't make sense for teachers to be reading one individual study unless it's the only study on the topic. And then if it is, then you got to kind of be like, well, it's interesting. We got one study, but we need to see more research. And that's why, generally speaking, if you're a teacher, I think it makes more sense to read a meta-analysis that's going to tell you what does all of the research show than, say, try to read all of the studies for yourself or become super literate on evaluating the quality of individual studies and trying to pick out, like, well, what's the best study on the topic? Because that gets real complex real fast.
So how can a teacher evaluate the quality of a meta-analysis? Because they're not all created equal either, are they?
No, they're not. And there are tons of criticism papers out there of meta-analysis. And I will throw one little dig at the people who write those criticisms. I think usually when people write a criticism, it's because they don't like the results of a specific meta-analysis. They're kind of grumpy. This meta-analysis proves something works that they hate, or reverse, vice versa. It proves something doesn't work that they love, and they want to be like, ah, the real problem is meta-analysis. That said, a good meta-analysis should be only looking at experimental studies. Like I said, studies that have a treatment group and a control group. When you look at studies that are done before the 2000s, and there's tons of them, or meta-analyses before the 2000s, oftentimes they included studies that were both. Like the case studies where it's just the treatment group and no control group. And that creates really enormous effect sizes if you include those studies. So generally speaking, if you do a meta-analysis, the first thing I would say look for is, did they exclude case studies? And you'll see it. You just go to the inclusion criteria section and you read the section that says, did they exclude studies without control groups? If they didn't exclude studies without control groups, it's not going to be a very good meta-analysis, truthfully. Okay. There's some exceptions to that rule, but it's kind of too complicated to get into in a podcast. But another thing to look for is, did they use a moderator analysis? And I say that because, you know, a moderator analysis shows how results changed in different scenarios. Because sometimes meta-analysis shows a pedagogy works or a teaching method works in one scenario, but not another. So, for example, there was a growth mindset meta-analysis that came out this year or last year, and it got criticized because they gave one effect size. And they didn't really have a good moderator analysis. So they didn't show, like, well, how does this change across different scenarios?
Okay, gotcha.
So looking to see, do they have that moderator analysis? Another key thing for me. And then Some of the really high quality meta-analyses will have even more advanced stuff like a regression analysis, or they'll include things like, well, what was the results for standardized assessments? Because studies that don't use standardized assessments tend to show higher results. So the more level of control, the more they've modeled, like what happens in different scenarios, what the different kinds of studies show, in my opinion, the better the paper is.
So your book tackles a lot of different pedagogies, as you call them, in education. And for example, you talked about multiple intelligences theory and learning styles, and we talked about that a little bit previously. Just in general, what are some education fads that have been popular over the years or even currently that aren't based on science?
Yeah, I think obviously the big one that's going to come to mind for us right now is balanced literacy, which, you know, a funny story. I saw Shanahan a couple years ago write, in response to an article I wrote criticizing balanced literacy, he wrote, there's no such thing as balanced literacy. And he didn't qualify it in any way. And I was like, I actually emailed him about it like a week later. And I was like, what is he talking about? Obviously, there's a thing called balanced literacy. I was taught all about it in university, and all these teachers are teaching balanced literacy. But I kind of think he's right. And the reason I say that is because when I look at the definitions of balanced literacy and I look at the definitions of whole language, I can't tell the difference. I really think, truthfully, that balanced literacy is a rebranding of whole language. But I think the same could be said of science reading. I think a lot of ways science reading was just a rebrand of systematic phonics. Because systematic phonics, the big criticism you got was, well, they're only teaching phonics. So we came up with this term of structured literacy or science reading where we're like, no, it's not just phonics. It's other things too. And it was a good rebranding. I think it worked really well. And I think balanced literacy was, they were trying to say like, oh, we're not just teaching whole words. We're teaching phonics too, like a little bit of phonics, like a little bit. But the problem is that if you look at a whole language definition, they said the same thing, because whole word instruction actually came before whole language instruction. Yep. Mm-hmm. And it was just, they were teaching kids to memorize words. They weren't teaching phonics. So they came out with whole language. Well, we teach all of language, including phonics. And it's really all the same stuff. We've been really having the same debate for 20 years. But truthfully, it's kind of been settled for 20 years from a science perspective, in my opinion. We know a systematic phonics approach or a science reading approach or a structured literacy approach, whatever you want to call it, is more effective than a whole language approach or whole word approach. So that's the really big one out there right now. I think another one that comes up a lot more in math is this idea of inquiry-based learning. You hear things like productive struggle, or you hear discovery-based learning. I've in the past, not in my current school board, but in previous school boards, I won't say any specific ones, I've been told things like, never teach the kids a math formula. And I hear that all the time. And it was funny, I got in a debate on Twitter about that, and somebody said, nobody's saying that. And somebody angrily replied to them saying, I'm saying that. I was like, okay, yes, there are people, because this person's arguing for it. But there's no research to support this idea of never teaching formulas. And I think in a lot of ways, the whole language movement is really connected to this idea of not teaching directly, not teaching explicitly. It really is just kind of like a reinvention of the same argument. We're really talking about explicit instruction versus implicit instruction. Mm-hmm. And for the most part, research seems to support a more explicit approach over a less explicit approach. And I think it's the danger of having that discussion too, is that we can get into this like a dichotomy of like, well, it's DI versus inquiry-based learning. And that's probably not true. Like, there's probably incidences where we want to use inquiry-based learning, and there's probably incidents where we want to use explicit instruction or direct instruction, whatever you want to call it. And we really need to find that balance. Like, the term balanced literacy is actually not a terrible term. Like, we do need to have a balance of things in our instruction. And we need to consider the holistic well-being of the kid as well as their academic success. But largely, we know that the more explicit your instruction is, probably the better the academic outcomes are going to be. So it's a lot of what we need to do in a classroom, I think, is balancing, well, how do we make school a fun and engaging place while also making it a place where they're going to learn a lot?
Yeah, well, let's talk a little bit more then about Chapter 13, which is constructivist teaching versus traditional teaching. And can you talk a little bit about the way you see the difference between traditional and constructivist teaching? How are they different? I know there's a lot of nuance in there in terms of things that are hard to tease out. So maybe talk to us about that.
Yeah, well, it is incredibly difficult to talk about, actually, because there's so much complexity here and nuance. But constructivism was originally a learning theory that basically said learning doesn't happen in a straight line, and it's going to be unique to every student, and their social experiences are going to impact it. And there's some truth to that. I mean, how many people learned all of their learning in a specific sequence exactly as their teacher intended them to learn?
Right.
Whereas the traditional understanding of learning really came more from this idea of learning is linear. You learn step one, you learn step two, you learn step three, you learn step four, and your teacher gives that knowledge to you. Whereas like constructivist idea was like, well, kids are going to discover some knowledge. They're going to discover some from here, some from there, and they're going to really make their own understanding. And if I have to say which learning theory is better, I'd say constructivism. But if I had to say, but then we get into, can we teach based on a constructivist model and be like, well, we're going to intentionally make our teaching non-linear and non-explicit, then it gets a lot more foggy. And this is where, you know, shout out to Corey Peltier. He's always saying, you know, it's not supposed to be a teaching method. It's supposed to be a theory of learning. But we had a whole bunch of teaching methods that were based on this constructivist learning idea. And to some extent, we can say this fits under a progressive model under education. And I kind of hate that idea because it kind of phrases this as a left versus right thing. And I think that's right. A very dangerous idea. I don't want to politicize education. And there's good ideas on the left about education, and there's good ideas on the right about education, which I hate to say because truthfully, I'm not very right-wing. I'm pretty left-wing. I'm pretty progressive myself. But when we break that into a teaching method, it becomes very difficult to teach based on this, like, linear step-by-step method. But then evaluating it is even more difficult because, like I said, there's not one constructivist teaching method. There's like, you know, it's kind of like a hydra. It has like 10 heads and there's so many different ideas and schools of thought. Like, I've seen, shout out to someone who I don't agree with, generally speaking, I've seen Dr. Sam refer to balanced literacy and whole language as a constructivist teaching model for reading instruction. And I would generally, actually speaking, agree with him on this point, that it's a constructivist approach to teaching reading. Where we would disagree is I would say that that's probably not a good idea, and he would probably say it is. You know, and it's, you know, some things included in that constructivist model include things like problem-based learning, discovering-based learning, inquiry-based learning. These are all just different constructivist models. And even some of these ideas like cooperative-based learning sort of fit into this constructivist model too. So if you want to ask, is constructivist teaching effective, you got to ask, well, which version of it? Because there's so many different versions. And then you have to ask the question is, in what context? Because, okay, maybe discovery-based learning doesn't work, but does problem-based learning work? And does it work for a certain subject or a certain grade? That's all very different questions. So just phrasing things in this dichotomous lens is difficult. And I will say that this is one area where I think the media and education does a bad job of reporting on science, is we often refer to things as evidence-based or not, good or bad, science-based or not. And generally speaking, it's probably more like a continuum of evidence. You know, is something have a lot of evidence, a little bit of evidence, some evidence? Where is the context which makes sense? Unfortunately, I think it's really easy from a marketing perspective on all sides of these debates to just say, this is the answer. And saying like something really nuanced is not very sellable. It's not very marketable because people want easy answers. But I think we have to always balance being, you know, you and I are in a similar role. We're both teachers. We're both trying to communicate science to some extent to teachers. And I think we fall into this problem where the more we simplify what we say, the more marketable it becomes, the more easy it is for people to understand, but the less likely what we're saying is accurate. And the more accurate we become, the more nuanced we become, the harder it becomes for teachers to follow what we're trying to say, the harder.
Yeah, that is also true. Marketable. That's so true. So what's the answer?
I don't know. I'll get back to you on that. I'm always playing with this balance. And, you know, truthfully, it becomes harder and harder for me because over time, I'm a teacher, but I enjoy research. And I've been dabbling a little bit more and more into research. And my understanding has been going up a lot over time. I started this project really in 2018. And my knowledge is way higher today than it was in 2020 even or 2022. Mm-hmm. And I want to talk with more and more nuance, I find, the more I learn. But then I always worry that I'm disenfranchising the people who want to listen to what I have to say the more I add to it. So I'm always just, I think you just have to keep that in your brain. Like, okay, I have to balance accuracy with people understanding what I'm saying. You know, if I start to tell people about p-values and confidence intervals in my conversation, I might lose them. So, but you might have to understand those things yourself if you want to understand these things on a deep level.
I think sometimes it's helpful when talking to teachers of different, I mean, maybe someone who's a beginner to something, is to say clearly, I'm simplifying this. You know, this is not, there's a lot more to this. I'm going to give you the bare minimum. Sometimes that can help, I think. When I hear people say that to me, that helps.
That's solid evidence. I got to keep that in mind.
So, you know, one nice thing about your book is that you talk about all those different, like there's a chapter, constructivist versus traditional. And at the end of each chapter, you have summary points to remember, which I always love. Very, very helpful. And then some reflection questions so teachers could talk together about some of these things. And you also break it down very clearly with research references. So I think of this book as something that I don't have that right now. I just have all the pages printed for my printer. But when I get the actual book, I can see it as something that I can constantly refer to because I know that the evidence is listed there. And I think it would be just kind of a resource for teachers where if someone says, well, some particular thing is based on science, they can look up and see what references you've shared. But what about teachers that want to stay current? And I know you are unusual in that you really enjoy digging into research and most teachers aren't going to do that or conduct meta-analyses. What's your best advice for teachers? Because, you know, we talked about you don't want to just follow an individual, but at the same time, it's in some ways we need to kind of rely on people to translate for us because teachers aren't necessarily going to have the time to do that or the time to learn how to do that. So what's your advice for teachers?
Yeah, I think I got to give them a multifaceted answer if that's okay.
Sure.
I think, you know, like this book is actually a second edition. And I think it's a lot better than my first edition, like a ton better, but evidence changes over time. There's so many things that do change over time, and my opinion is constantly changing on things. I recently wrote a blog about changing my mind about reading recovery like 3 or 4 times. And I think one of the resources you can use, there's actually a website called Hattie MetaX. And
okay.
John Hattie has kept a database of all meta-analyses in education. And he has them broken down by topic. So you can click on almost any topic in education. And then you can see how many meta-analyses have been done on the topic. And you can see what is the average effect size for them. And then you can see, if you look more carefully, you can see, well, what is the context? Like, what grades was that for? And et cetera. So that's a really valuable tool. It's really quick and easy to use. Just go to Google, type in Hattie MetaX, and then look up the teaching factor you're going to look in. So that's the simplest answer. Now, there's people out there who would be like, well, we can't just look at meta-analysis. You got to understand deeper than just the one effect size. And I think then it does pay to follow some people in the space, you know. But I think when you're choosing people, it helps if you have a basic understanding of research to know if what they're saying is true. Because if you follow people and they say, what I'm saying is true because case study X or because Scarborough's rope or the simple view of reading, not to sort of throw anyone under the bus, but those are all theoretical things. They're not necessarily hard science. I think when you look at people, you should be asking, are they citing research studies to prove their point or to support their point?
Yes.
And I think that's really important. And I know you, Anna, like you're more, you're a podcaster, but you're interviewing a lot of researchers in the field. So I think you have a really valuable insight as being a teacher who's talking to researchers in person on a regular basis. So it's I think finding these voices is really valuable. I think you're a good person to follow. I think Dr. Shanahan is a good person to follow. I was actually just kind of like funnily going through my book citations, and I think I cited Shanahan 27 times. John Hattie is a good person to follow. I think just asking yourself, is this person citing research when they say something to support what they say? I think that's really valuable. Or at the very least, are they talking to researchers on a regular basis? Because I can think of a handful of podcasters in this space who also just constantly interview researchers. And I think that's also a valuable lens to look through. So
yeah,
if you don't want to do the research yourself, you have to find people who are actually staying up to date with the research.
Yeah, and even if the person you ask doesn't know, they could say, let me ask around, you know, I have a professor that I reach out to a lot, and she'll share some articles with me if I'm trying to find out what the research, if there's any research on a particular topic. And so sometimes it's about who you know that can find things for you. But I think that what you said before was really spot on, where if you're asking somebody about something and they try to cite something that's not an actual research article, then it's the wrong person to go to. But thankfully, as we know, like on Twitter, X, it's really a place to share these things, which was surprising to me a couple years ago. As you start to follow people, these things start to come up in your feed, and all of a sudden it's not such a mystery anymore.
I don't know why it is, but I find academics tend to be on Twitter more and teachers tend to be on Facebook more. So
yeah, Facebook isn't the place.
I've gotten some valuable information from Facebook over the years, but I feel like you do tend to get more opinions from the classroom on Facebook,
yeah,
and you tend to get more research cited on Twitter. I have no idea why that is. I think it's so weird that the academics have chosen Twitter and the teachers have chosen Facebook, but that definitely seems to be a thing. I think another valuable sign is if someone says, I don't know. You talk about that. Mm-hmm. I have to look that up. That's a great sign. If people are like, I don't know, or if that's not my area of expertise, or like, I would have to look that up. That means that they're being honest. If someone's like, I know everything about everything, that's a terrible sign. Because nobody knows everything.
I heard a presentation with Jan Hasbrook at one time, who of course we know is really about fluency. She knows many things, but she talks most about fluency. And she said something, I can't remember it exactly, but it was like, whenever someone asks a question about comprehension, I want to go hide, or something like that. She was just open about this wasn't her top area. And of course, I'm sure she knows a ton about it, but she recognizes that she specializes in certain things. And that's, so like you said, that's really comforting to hear. You don't want to hear somebody think they know everything.
I feel that way about assessment. People will sometimes ask me questions about assessment, and I'm like, oh, don't ask me about that. Ask somebody else.
Yeah, I have, for a lot of questions that people ask me, I have like a list of places to send them to get them if I really don't know. But thankfully, we can all keep learning, and your book is a great way to get teachers to feel like they're not completely in the dark when someone shares details of a study. Like their head doesn't have to spin when they hear effect size. Like they can get the general idea of what that means, and that's where we all have to start. It's just be familiar with these basic terms, and then we can start to be part of the conversation.
And I don't think it's that complicated. You know, I heard this idea that, well, it's too hard for teachers. They can't learn. I don't think that's true. I'm a teacher. Like, I'm in a classroom every day, and I don't expect everybody to have the same passion for research that I do. But I think it's kind of condescending and demeaning that we say, well, teachers don't need to know research. I disagree. I think it's pertinent to our jobs.
Well, you're doing a great job of making this a thing that teachers can aspire to, now that there's a guide basically to understanding research, and then the way you broke down specific areas. So I'm really excited for your book to come out for real. Now, I don't remember, I don't know for sure when this podcast is going to air, but probably about the time that your book is coming out. So can you give us the exact date?
I forgot to look it up. I was starting to look it up before. I think it's April 26th.
Okay,
but
I can update that
on that day too, so it might be just in my head. I'm like, oh, day of my conference, day the book comes out, and my brain's just confusing dates. But I do know it's at the end of April.
Okay, good. I'll update that when I add the ending to this. Well, thanks for talking about it. I'm really excited to get my hands, and I know a lot of teachers will be too.
Thanks for having me on your podcast again.
As it turns out, Nate's book is being released on May 7th, 2024. So head over to Amazon and get your copy. And you can find the show notes for today's episode at themeasuredmom.com/episode166. Talk to you next time.
That's all for this episode of Triple R Teaching. For more educational resources, visit Anna at her home base, themeasuredmom.com, and join our teaching community. We look forward to helping you reflect, refine, and recharge on the next episode of Triple R Teaching.